Life.
Boy howdy.
So here's a funny thing.
What's that?
I can hear not only
my fan,
the hand fan that you've got working on your face right now, so stop it.
It's hot in
it
here.
It doesn't matter. Ugh. The other thing is, Bibbs drew my attention to this thing.
That you can hear the ceiling
you
fan
can hear the ceiling
during our show.
No one has ever said anything to me about it.
I was listening to
no
some
one
old,
has ever complained about it.
I was listening to some old episodes while I was in Europe on the continent.
Yeah.
And I noticed, oh God, you could totally hear our fan going.
Should we turn it off?
No.
Well, okay, not today, but like, because it's gross today. But
yes.
Maybe in
generally
the future,
speaking,
in the future, maybe we ought to have it not on. So you're going to suffer through the fan noise today. Just let it soothe you. It
yes.
doesn't.
Think of it as it's the ocean in the background.
Yeah, yeah.
It's white noise.
No, you have to not do that.
I need this.
No, you don't. That handband's got to go. Because that's you're going boom, 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 boom.
All right,
with
all
that.
Right, fine. I'm dying.
I'm taking it fully out of your reach.
You're terrible.
No, I'm helping the... Well, listen. Audiophiles
are not listening
who
to
listen
this
to this show.
Show. They ran screaming a long time. They ran screaming the day you ate a potato chip. And they never come back. This is a podcast.
I apologized for that, and I never did it again.
I know, but still, we lost him. This is a podcast of the cinema. My name is Alonzo Duraldi. I'm film reviews editor for The Wrap and a film critic for What the Flick on the YouTube network The Young Turks.
Hello, Alonzo. My name is Dave White. I am a film critic for linoleum-knife.com. Not right now.
I was going to say.
I mean... While I finish writing the book, I've sort of abandoned everything.
Okay.
And
is there an end to the
watch
sabbatical?
Watch your step. Watch yourself
Does
with
the
these questions.
Have a closing
watch,
date?
Watch your mouth with these questions.
I'm just curious. Your public demands to know.
My public can wait until I'm done.
All right.
Yes, I missed my deadline. My self-imposed deadline, I missed my deadline. You know what else? I'm still working.
Okay.
It's not like I quit doing it.
I know.
So you just have a seat.
You know.
While the author
you,
continues his toilings.
You established parameters.
I did. Officially. I'm officially announcing it right now. I missed my deadline.
Fine.
I have not completed the book by the appointed, my self-appointed deadline.
All right. You
know
what?
You got anything sassy to say about it?
Our listeners are used to us saying that we're going to have things done by a certain time.
Listen,
and then
no,
not.
That never happens. The times.
Every extra episode we've ever promised
never has
come
happened
late.
On time.
We still haven't set up our subscription program
I
that
like
we've been
prompt,
talking about for the
I
better
like
part of this year.
Prompt behavior. In general, but you know what I've learned about work?
What's that?
It always takes longer than you think it's going to take.
Well, yeah.
It never finishes on time. It is never ready when you think it's going to be ready.
Mm.
Your best intentions are going to be postponed. Listen, things happen.
Yes.
The audiobook's done. My part of
oh,
it
your
anyway.
Part of it is done.
I finished that recording. You finished engineering. We're just waiting for the editing
to wrestle it to the
and
ground.
It's, and that's in process. He's working on it.
Yes.
So yeah. Listen, things are going slowly, but things are going.
All right.
Just you be relaxed. You personally.
I'm a real chill bro.
Yeah.
In the way
anyway,
that you are freewheeling.
Anyway, Alonzo Duraldi. My name's Dave White.
Yes.
I'm the co-host of this podcast with you.
Mm-hmm.
I am also the man to whom you are married.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps you've forgotten about these things during your time away in Europe, Italy.
Hardly.
These are facts. I'm debriefing you from your Italian job.
You were only supposed to blow the bloody doors off.
Sorry, I'm moving the microphone.
All right. It's nice to be home. It's nice to be back doing this show with you in the same room as opposed to the separate but equal programs we were doing while I was gone.
You did one with Peter DeBruce.
Correct.
And you guys came off all, apparently, how did the lady on Twitter say?
Full of ourselves.
Full of yourself.
And grasping for something intelligent to say.
Self-absorbed, grasping for things that were intelligent to say. Because you're both such dummies.
Yeah, apparently so.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she told
us. Thanks, Twitter lady.
Yeah. She told me.
What was her name? Did she give a name?
I don't feel like sharing it on the air.
Stupid bee just flew into the house.
I think we'll just refer to the lady on Twitter as Stupid Bee as well and leave it at that.
Oh, Stupid Bee really did just fly into the house.
Yes, well, he'll figure out that the sliding glass door is open.
No, he won't. I'm going to open the door so Stupid Bee can get out. Keep talking.
All right. Okay. So, yeah. So, I was at the Venice Film Festival, which was great. And then while I was gone, you taped a podcast with our good friend Bibbs of the B-Movies podcast over at Crave Online. So, thank you, Bibbs, for sitting in and doing all the technical stuff, since heaven knows Dave White will never figure it out. And also, during all this, you and I were both interviewed on Matt Baume's podcast, The Sewers of Paris. Which was a lot of fun to do, and I think that came out really well. He, I think, was originally going to give us a shared episode and then discovered that we are talking men, and so we each got our own individual one. Okay, yay, you got rid of the bee.
I just hit it with coat hangers and made it run away. You ever hit a bee with a coat hanger?
Not today.
I didn't kill it.
Okay, no.
It still, well, I'm not part of the bee problem.
No.
It flew off.
Yes.
I may have stunned it a little bit. Yeah, Sewers of Paris, you and I are both so full of life and fascinating. We required our own individual episodes.
Indeed, yeah. So we get...
And that's appropriate.
We went deeply biographical, so if you are remotely interested in that sort of thing...
Your life was different than mine before we met.
Yeah, no, I...
After we met, your life became sort of enfolded into mine.
Or yours into mine.
And
really,
I took control.
That's not at all what happened, but... No, I remember telling Matt, I said, we kind of have very different paths. Because the show is about the pop culture that shapes gay men. And yeah, you and I came from very different paths.
Yeah, I think very different is an understatement sometimes.
Wholly autonomous routes.
All right, so we have 8 films on our list.
Right, well, we're counting...
Now, we're gonna mention the fact that Sicario opens this week
and it's
on... 6 screens nationwide.
It's really great.
You have seen it.
Yes, you can read my review at The Wrap, or you can see my review at What the Flick, and then next week, Dave will have seen it, and we will talk about it.
Correct. We're going to wait a week. It opens wide next week.
Okay.
That's when we'll talk about it.
Great.
I'm going to go see it this week sometime. Nice morning screening.
You do that.
My favorite thing.
Yes.
And then there's another wide release that I have not seen that you have. The Scotch Tape, The Scorch, what?
The Maze Runner, The Scorch Trials.
Yeah, that's stupid.
Which you are not going to see.
No, I'm not.
So I might as well.
I saw the first one.
Yeah.
Which stars, you know what? I don't remember who the
His
dumb...
name is Dylan O'Brien.
I don't remember any of the kids.
He's on, like, Teen Wolf.
I don't care.
And
that movie stars Patricia Clarkson being great and looking exactly like our friend Shannon Lee.
Yes, yes. And she pops up a couple of times in this one as well.
Why don't you talk about it for like 3 minutes?
Yeah.
And then
done. Okay, basically it's, you know, you get these YA movies that just sort of feel like the bottom of the ashtray of all the other YA movies. This just feels like cobble together bits of other post-apocalypses and other chosen ones and other bleh. I will say this.
I really do prefer the the top of the line, bleh, yes, instead of the other bleh.
If you're going to give me this, you know, make it a little fresh. I will say this in its favor. The action sequences in and of themselves are pretty good. The kind of gross, scary stuff with the zombie-ish, you know, afflicted people are okay. However, these sequences occur in a vacuum of no characters that I care about, and I'm not invested in this world, and I'm not interested in the plot. So, basically what I'm saying is there were a few things that kept me awake, but generally speaking...
What were those things?
You know, like I said, like there were some big action sequences, you know, running and jumping and blowing up and stuff.
I remember there being some bugs in the first one. They run and fight the giant bugs. Am I wrong about that, or is that Starship Troopers?
It is Starship Troopers. I don't know if it's also... I barely remember the Maze Runner.
Right.
It was that much of a bleh.
While you speak, I'm pulling up my old movies.com review of The Maze Runner to remember, see if I liked it or not.
Yeah, I meant to dig up mine just to remember what it was, you know. It's a lot of nothing, and this movie's mostly a lot of nothing, but at least, like I said, the action-y and scary stuff are sort of skillful, but given that I didn't care about any of the people involved, that sort of took away from it. So it's a general waste of time that you really don't need to see. Unless you are really, really into, you know... the books on which they're based, and I'm sure at some point we'll get to the last one and have to suffer through two movies based on it, because that's the rule now.
Yeah, there were giant spider monsters.
Okay.
In the other one.
If you say so, all I remember about the first movie is an elevator and walls. And Patricia Clarkson. Right.
And Patricia Clarkson shows up at the end and explains exactly what's going on.
Yes. This one has a lot of really good actors completely... wasting their time. Like Lily Taylor has two scenes and Barry Pepper has three scenes, and like Giancarlo Esposito gets some things to do, but it's kind of like, oh yeah, let's hire some legitimate actors to go with all these fresh faced blank teenagers. Although some of the teens are okay. The kid from Love Actually is all right.
Oh, is he in it too?
Yeah. Thomas Brody Sangster, I think is his name. But yeah, whatever. And frankly, the thing afterwards, neither Christy nor I were quite sure what a Scorch trial even was.
Oh, did they explain that?
Not really.
Not really.
The Scorch.
You're going to get scorched.
The Scorch is what they call sort of like, you know, the wasteland outside of the, you know, protected areas.
Did they just decide that wasteland was not a word they wanted to use anymore?
Beats me. Scorch! It's so catchy.
Hmm. So, the end of talking about that movie.
Yes, that's fine by me.
I've had a great moment listening to you talk about it.
Now, are you going to see Sleeping with Other People? Because I'd like to talk about that at some point. I know you didn't like.
I don't know.
I know you didn't like. What was that movie called? Not Bridesmaids.
What?
The one with Rebel Wilson as the woman who's getting married and her friends are all terrible.
Oh, that god-awful movie. Yeah. What was that called?
I didn't see it.
Bachelorette.
Bachelorette, thank you.
What does that have to do with this one?
Same director.
Same writer?
I think she wrote, directed both of them.
Oh, really?
But this one, I mean, look, I didn't see Bachelorette, but I remember why you hated it. This one
It's made of throw-up. That's why I didn't like it.
This one I found really funny and charming and kind of subversive. You might like it.
We'll see about that. Did it open this weekend?
It opened last weekend, actually.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Talk about it. I may never get to it.
All right, fine. Jason Sudeikis and Alison Brie play these people who they have like one disastrous date when they're both undergrads and don't see each other again until years later when they meet at a Sexual Compulsives Anonymous group, which he doesn't quite think he is one, but he's sort of being forced into it by his current fiance. And she is more of a love addict in that she is still completely hung up on this guy that she's into, even though he's married and, you know, just sort of seeing her on the side, is this dentist played by Adam Scott. And, you know, it's one of those, it's your basic romantic comedy where they're buddies and then they realize that they're right for each other, you know. But in a very smart way.
Like you and me.
For instance.
We were buddies. And then you were like, wait, how can I just have him be a buddy? He's so perfect for me. What have I been thinking about this entire time?
The more you tell that story your way, the more I regret my decision making. By the way, big thanks to Cindy, listener Cindy.
Oh, yeah.
For very generously showering us with anniversary presents this week.
Our anniversary isn't for like another 10 days.
Yeah.
Or more, 2 weeks almost.
Something like that.
Yeah.
But yeah, just many, many generous items.
Like you sent us gifts. And
yeah.
That's crazy.
We really appreciate it.
And yet we are also very grateful.
Yes.
You know what? I never turned down a present.
No, heavens.
They're fantastic. I have a piece of ice in my mouth. I'm sorry.
Mm. Yeah.
Talk about this stupid movie.
Anyway, it's not a stupid movie. It's actually...
Says you.
It's really smart and it's really funny. There's a sequence where... Jason Sudeikis implements a water bottle to instruct Alison Brie on the finer art of female self-satisfaction that I thought was very funny. And you know, it's bawdy, but also clever. And, yeah, I liked it a lot. It was one of the better movies I saw at Sundance this year.
Oh, so you saw it at Sundance?
Yeah.
So you had not enough oxygen. Go into your brain. Is that what it was?
That's what it is, Dave White.
I'll probably see it. I mean,
I'm sure it'll be on demand.
I saw
weeks.
Madonna's first movie, Filth and Wisdom.
Yeah.
And that was an incoherent, inept mess.
Right.
And then I saw W.E.
Mm-hmm.
And that was neither incoherent nor inept.
No, it was fully ept.
So, maybe this bachelorette person
mm-hmm.
has pulled it out.
Maybe.
Maybe the learning curve is equal or greater
than Madonna's.
Than Madonna's.
Could be.
I'll wait until the DVD shows up.
All right, fine.
The DVD will eventually show up at this house.
I would imagine, yes.
Yeah. I don't want to spend any money.
All right.
You know I hate spending money.
I know, yes. Yeah. Now, what you did spend your own money on is a new batch of faith-based movies.
Yeah.
That you saw without me.
So
I want your book report now.
Okay. This is going to take a minute. If you're waiting to hear about Everest or Black Mass or The New Girlfriend.
We're getting there.
Settle in, kids. Because I saw three Christian movies. Anyone who's new to this podcast, you should know that I come to the Christian movie full of knowledge. I grew up in the conservative evangelical world. I know this scenario intimately.
And if you want to hear more about Dave's background in religiosity,
listen to the Sewers,
of,
to Paris.
Sewers of Paris.
Yeah. So, okay, the first one I went to see was War Room.
The smash hit
the
War Room.
The smash hit War Room. The number one movie at the box office over Labor Day.
Right.
And I think the weekend after that, too, right? It was number one then, too?
Maybe.
It was number one at the box office for at least one weekend, but it has made a heap of cash.
Hmm.
It is about a woman whose husband is mean to her. He doesn't hit her, but he's not nice to her. He's cruel. He controls her. He controls the household money. He's petty. He's short-tempered. He's a jerk. Furthermore, he's got his mind on another lady. But we'll get to that in a second. So the wife is distraught. There is no one famous in this film.
No Kirk Cameron, no Tyler Perry.
No, however, it is made by the people who made Fireproof and Courageous and maybe something else. But it's a church in the southeastern part of the United States. I don't remember now exactly what state they're in. But this church has its own film production situation going on. And they are essentially like a little Tyler Perry...
mini studio.
Mini studio coming up. And they make movies that are really cheap and are increasing in production value and budget. And I must say, in quality, because I have seen all of them.
Quality in terms of just the rudimentary basics of filmmaking? Or
yeah, yeah. And they are self-contained. Like, I took our pal Gary Cotty, who works in film. And every time I take Gary Cotty to a movie, we absolutely, although I do this myself anyway, he always sits through the credits to see who he knows who worked on the film. He didn't know anybody. And I said, well, there's a reason you don't know anybody. It's they go real deep in-house for this stuff.
Parishioners.
Now, he did recognize background. Because similar... because it's the same part of the country where they used to shoot Banshee.
It was North Carolina, right?
Yeah, the show where he, the show that he worked on. Some of the same background people showed up in this one. So she's, she's unhappy. She meets an old woman played by an actress who's about 45 doing an Estelle Getty kind of
gray wig.
Yeah. And the old woman meets her and says, I'm going to teach you how to pray. Not so that things are fixed, but, for yourself and so that you can stop being angry at your husband.
Even though the husband deserves having anger aimed at
him. Even though the husband deserves having anger aimed at him.
Yes.
So she prays. And spoiler, everything is okay at the end.
Is it like that line in Ab Fab where she talks about chanting as being a cosmic cash machine?
Do you want me to really spoil the movie?
This movie has been out for weeks, so yes, spoiler.
Here's how I can help you to understand what happens in this film.
Okay.
You remember about 15 years ago, and I think the listeners, if they've been listening long enough, have heard me discuss this film and this other film that I'm about to mention. A 2000-2001 Israeli film called Ushpizin.
Yes.
About the Jewish holiday of Sukkot.
I remember you talking about this.
And this, a man and a woman, childless, mm-hmm. but they keep praying to G-D mm-hmm. to give him a son. Not just any baby.
Yeah, no.
A son.
Yes.
All right.
A masculine child.
So along comes the Sukkot holiday, and I'm sure I'm pronouncing that wrong, but I'm not Jewish, since I don't, and no one I know who is Jewish celebrates this holiday because it's a minor one.
Right.
But it's that one where you set up the hut in your yard.
Yes.
And you say, hello, weary travelers. Come to my hut and sleep. I will give you rest, and also you may feast on all of my banquet of food. So this couple in the movie does that, and along come these criminal dudes. And they're like, oh, we're scared of the criminals, but, we have to be hospitable to them. That is the law. The law is hospitality. So they let them stay in the hut, and then everything's great. And the criminal dudes, I can't remember now if they get caught or if they turn from their wicked ways or whatever. But because they were faithful, because they did as God commanded, they get a boy child at the end of this movie.
Not to be confused with the Mormon film God's Army.
That's what I was about to mention next.
Where at the end of the movie, the Mormon missionaries all pray over the guy in a wheelchair who can then walk.
Yes. Okay, so... that's the background. Mm-hmm. In War Room, the lady prays.
The wife.
Yeah.
Not the old lady.
Old lady and the young lady, they pray together.
Yeah.
And they pray that the husband's not cheating on her. And as they pray, at the moment they pray, the husband is out to dinner with the other lady. And he gets food poisoning. so he cannot commit the dirty penis deed that he was fixing to do. Then he turns from his wicked ways and comes back to her, and he loves her and he treats her like a queen. And then he gets involved in his daughter's double dutch team.
Okay.
And the ending of the movie is a glorious 5-minute double dutch competition sequence, and they come in second.
Because they didn't pray enough.
I don't know if it's because they didn't pray enough or because, like, the filmmakers were like, no, let's keep it real. Okay.
The Bad News Bears don't win at the end.
They don't. The Bad News Bears don't win at the end of the Bad News Bears. They lose. And then they tell the other team to take that trophy and shove it straight up their asses. And I can say that on this clean podcast of the cinema, because you can say that on 2.5 Men. I watched my first episode of 2.5 Men recently.
Why?
With the sound off. Just so I could see. I was ironing. Just so I could see if I could figure out what was happening.
Oh, with no volume.
Like what the show was about, because I've never seen it before. And in the show, two women did a lot of cooking and cleaning for these guys. Mm-hmm. And then, Charlie Sheen is sick in bed, and one of them is tending to him. But the other one is just, like, all they're doing is constantly serving food, like, bringing them their meals on trays and stuff. And I was like, does that happen every episode? Is that what this show's about? These lazy guys are sitting around and women serve them hand and coffee and treats. So anyway, the movie was over and Gary Cuddy goes, what am I supposed to learn from this film? And I said, you're not. You are not supposed to learn anything from this movie. You are not supposed to have seen this movie. This movie is not for you. This movie is for people who already believe that prayer is a supernatural force that will work, you know, in the economy of you and God, where God is intimately interested in all of the details of your personal life.
So this is not designed to proselytize.
No.
This is a Sunday school lesson
for
the choir.
Yes, this is for Christians by Christians. And that is actually the way these Christian movies have been going. With very few exceptions, most of these films are by Christians, about Christians, for Christians. And you are not, if you don't believe the same exact way that conservative evangelicals believe, then there's no point in you seeing the film. You're not going to be convinced of anything,
but,
because it feels weird.
No, I agree with you, but I feel like they've at least tried to pretend, like in a movie like Do You Believe or
right.
God's Not Dead.
Do You Believe is...
They're trying to pretend that there's outreach going on.
Do You Believe is sort of an outwardly directed film.
But even still, it operates in
but
that vacuum.
It does
vacuum
operate
of
in that world where this is how we
our
see
way
the
or
world.
The highway.
Yeah, this is how we see the world, and this is how the world really is.
Right. This is how we see the world, and we're right.
Objectively speaking, the world is the way we see it and experience it.
Yes.
And if you don't, then not only are you not one of us, but you are outside of the box that God exists in.
Right.
And if you're not in that box, then you better watch out.
You're going to hell.
Well, yeah, and so, and it's just a very strange. So, if you don't understand this world, if you don't understand the idea of wifely submission to the husband, which is something that is discussed in War Room,
oh brother,
then you're going to think, well, this is a creepy anti-feminist, you know, piece of garbage, and. And yes, you are right. And yet, at the same time, Christian audiences, conservative Christian audiences, they see this film, and their vocabulary is not the same as everyone else's. So when they say things like the wife should submit to the husband, they don't always necessarily mean that the wife should just obey everything the husband says. What they mean is the wife should, in spite of herself, should continue to sort of prop up the man, do good by the man, and through faith in God, hope and pray that he sees her sacrifice. I prefer
the movies where when the woman catches her husband cheating...
Sets him on fire.
No, she she takes all of his clothes out of the bathroom while he's taking a shower and then covers the floor in baby oil.
That was a great moment in feminist cinema. Yes. Continue talking about that and explain to people what you're talking about.
I'm talking about the contemporary holiday classic This Christmas.
a film that we genuinely support and love.
Yes.
This is like a fun, mediocre Christmas movie.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So Regina King finds out that her man has been... cheating on her.
Yeah.
So when he comes back from this quote-unquote business trip, she greets him in a black nightie and is all like, oh baby, oh baby, and tells him to take a shower. While he's taking a shower, she puts on a pair of jeans, takes all of his clothes and the towels and everything out of the bathroom.
Everything. The bath mat, everything.
Anything that could be used to, like, you know, for traction. Covers the floor in baby oil, and then as he's sliding around, she takes his belt and just
starts whipping him.
And then kicks him out. After she's already wrecked his Mercedes.
Yes, we're laughing about domestic violence.
But it's, yeah, it's pretty great.
But it's kind of revenge domestic violence.
Exactly. He started it. So, I'm more down with that brand of this.
And it's played for big laughs.
Yes.
And oh, did it get them.
Oh, yeah.
In the theater that we were in.
Definitely.
It was fantastic.
Crowd pleaser. All right, what else have you seen that was Bible-based?
I saw Captive, which opens this weekend.
Right.
This is a wide release.
Right.
It stars Kate Bosworth and
Kate Mara.
Kate Mara and David Oyelowo.
Mm-hmm.
It's a true story. It is about a woman who is a recovering crystal meth addict who, at random, is chosen by an escaped murderer, rapist and murderer, who has raped a woman and murdered four people as he escaped from prison. So his escape from prison involves him killing four people. A judge, a court reporter, a sheriff, and an FBI person, I think.
Dag.
Yeah. And so he gets her in her apartment. He just gets her at random.
Mm-hmm.
Hiding out in her apartment. She, at her most recent recovery meeting, has been given a copy of a book called The Purpose-Driven Life, which she does not care about. She's just sort of like, whatever, church. Like, she doesn't care.
I'm sure at 12-step meetings you get handed a lot of literature.
Right. But she's got it in the house.
Yeah.
She hasn't been looked at it yet, but she got it in the house. The author of The Purpose-Driven Life is a man named Rick Warren. We'll get to him in a minute.
Mm-hmm. Him, I know.
He is, as the kids say on the internet, problematic. In a major way. So, here's the weird thing that happens in this movie. She reads him half a dozen sentences out of The Purpose-Driven Life. There is one sequence in which she begins reading, and then, you know, there's that sort of like time passing.
Oh, right.
And she's still reading. So we assume that she's been reading to him for what? 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes.
So
because this is all over the course of him eating a plate of pancakes. So we'll give him the benefit of the doubt and let us assume that he's a very slow eater.
So for a movie that's about this woman reading him this book while they don't even bother to show you the book being read or to hear it?
Ish. About half a dozen. The audience gets to hear about half a dozen sentences.
Oh, brother.
About how God should be your first priority in life. And that is your purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the minute she is done reading that book to him, he's like, all right, I know you have to meet your little daughter at her fashion show event, school event thing. And if you don't show up, she's going to wonder, and there's people are going to wonder where you are, and they're going to come looking for you. So why don't you just leave? He lets her go. He lets her go. Mind you, he also breaks into her stash of crystal meth and goes and takes it and goes bonkers for the good first chunk of the film. Uh-huh. Waving guns around and being like, we're going to rob a bank. You're coming with me.
I've got an idea for a screenplay.
Right. But she calms him down with pancakes and a Rick Warren book. And he lets her go.
As you do.
He lets her go. And then the FBI comes in and gets him. The end. Like, that's the movie. It's this really quiet movie where almost nothing happens. Where they're sitting in her apartment for a good chunk of the film. And not a whole lot goes on. Because it is a true story, it's not like they can super embellish it.
Right.
It's a true story that happened about 5 years ago. So it's not like they can really embellish it crazily and make you think that something else happened that
so
didn't.
Big ending isn't that he, like, comes to Jesus. He just basically just lets her go.
He just lets her go. And then
maybe he just doesn't want to hear any more of that book. Please, just go. Just go.
Okay, so it gets better.
Oh.
He lets her go. The cops get him. The movie's over. Then come the post movie.
Oh boy. Title cards.
Scrawl and things that, you know, here's what happened next to these people.
It's called The Computer.
No, she wrote a book about it.
Right.
She wound up on Oprah.
Mm. Of course.
And they show you the clip of Oprah with her and Rick Warren.
Mm-hmm.
Oprah says to this woman, you gave crystal meth to a man with a gun in your apartment. And she's like, uh-huh. And Oprah says, well, Jesus must really love you. The theologian, Most Reverend Oprah Winfrey, understands that Jesus is selective about who he loves and loves people in a more qualitative way than others. So that when you do something especially stupid, Jesus will protect you.
The angels work overtime.
Yeah. Then they bring out that loathsome piece of garbage, Rick Warren. Now let's talk about Rick Warren.
Let's.
He wrote The Purpose-Driven Life.
He runs something called the
Saddleback Church here in Southern California. He's a mega church pastor.
You may recall candidate Barack Obama toadying to him during the 2008 election.
Oh, more than toadying. Going to Saddleback and denouncing marriage equality.
Yes, on
that
stage,
is
on television.
Our opportunistic president.
Yes.
Yeah. Who I generally love.
We support you, but boy, we have not forgotten that visit to Saddleback.
I don't forget how he waffled on us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Would you like to continue?
No, that was my main
thing. You haven't talked in a minute. Why don't you say everything you know about Rick Warren?
Rick Warren is a scumbag, basically. He's an opportunistic.
Oh, there's more.
Oh, please.
There's more about Rick Warren.
Oh, do. Tell me.
Perhaps you've heard of the country of Uganda.
Oh, right. Yes.
Oh, right. Yes. Perhaps you've heard about Martin Sempa.
Mm-hmm. They eat the poo-poo like ice cream? Martin Sempa?
Yes, they eat the poo-poo like ice cream. That is a really exciting video from Martin Sempa that's on YouTube that you can listen to.
And you can also see it as
one of my favorites.
You can see it as part of the great documentary God Loves Uganda, which is about American evangelicals exporting an exceedingly toxic brand of homophobia to Africa, specifically to Uganda.
Yeah. And so Rick Warren, Martin Sempa was one of his sort of proteges.
Mm.
And when the Kill the Gays law came along in Uganda, when they finally developed that, that's when Rick Warren and Scott Lively, because they were down there together.
Right. Scott Lively, who has since been brought up on crimes against humanity
charges. Crimes against humanity charges,
yes.
Both he and Scott Lively said, "Oh, wait. We can't associate with a law that says kill homosexuals.
Yeah.
We just want it to be illegal and for them to experience some kind
of discrimination
and or punishment."
Right.
But then what happens is the gays are being lynched and they're being thrown in prison. And so now Scott Lively has not been as successful as Rick Warren at backpedaling.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Warren has gone so far as to say that he was never a part of it,
uh-huh.
was never a part of anything related to do with Ugandan anti-gay policies, that these are rumors started, he claims, by Rachel Maddow. Yeah. This is what he says. I did my homework on this man
so
I could talk about this. And so this is the creep who wrote The Purpose-Driven Life.
Yes.
And who is a liar about his own participation in laws in Uganda that are actively killing queer people.
Right.
Yeah. So go to hell, Rick Warren.
And take your movie with you.
And honestly, if Oprah is still cozy with him, she can go to hell too.
All right.
Yeah. So, okay, now, one more film, 90 yes. Minutes in Heaven, which I saw today at the Burbank Mall. My favorite mall.
The Burbank Mall.
My favorite theater in my favorite mall.
Where movies go to die and or be put to death. Upstairs from Magnifique Mademoiselle.
Yeah, this opened this weekend.
No, actually it opened last weekend.
No, I think it was this past weekend. No. Captive opened this weekend.
Yeah.
90 Minutes in Heaven.
Yeah, because remember, it was in Glendale.
It was in Glendale, and then it moved.
Now it's in Burbank.
But then it got dumped in the Burbank Mall. I'm sorry.
It wasn't even good enough for Glendale.
This one does, in fact, star Kate Bosworth.
Yes.
And Hayden Christensen.
Right.
As a sort of sexy Ned Flanders, I gotta say. Like, he's got 1989 puffy hair and that mustache. I was like, you're looking all right, Hayden Christensen, as a preacher. So he plays a preacher in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
Again, true story. He wrote a book about it. Preacher in Texas, he gets involved in a car accident, and he dies. Now, the film is called 90 Minutes in Heaven. But his death in the film lasts for approximately 90 seconds.
Well, how long was he dead on the table?
Well, in the car. He was dead in the car. Well, according to the film, I haven't read the book, but according to the film, he was dead in the car for 90 minutes. And then his pulse came back.
Really?
Yeah. Which I assume can happen. Am I wrong? I think that bodies are weird. They do weird things.
Any MDs out there who want to write in on that one?
I don't
one?
Know. Why don't you know. Ask some of the MBs? Why don't you ask some of the MDs that you happen to be related
well,
to?
Well, if I'd known beforehand, I would have, but I'll try that for next time.
Anyway, dead.
Okay.
Then,
not dead.
Springs back to life. It is not until 1 hour and 45 minutes into the film that he utters the words, "I was in heaven for 90 minutes." During his time in the car, his seconds of death in the car, you see him heading toward a golden light,
mm-hmm.
like in the sky, and all these folks coming at him being like, "Welcome, welcome, 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 welcome." They call him by name. "We're so happy to have you." You know. He sits on it. Like, he keeps this close to his chest. He's not telling anybody about how he went to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
Reason? He's a grown-up. Unlike that little four-year-old who was like, "I went to heaven!" Whatever that kid's name was.
The heaven is for real.
Burpo.
Kid.
Is that their last name? Was Burpo or something crazy like that?
Natty Bumpo.
Yeah, that kid. The kid was like, "I went to heaven. I saw Jesus." He keeps it quiet. And so the film is a nearly 2 hour sort of recovery drama where he slowly, inch by inch, recovers his ability to move and walk and to come to terms with his anger. Mm-hmm. His anger, it turns out, is directed toward God because he
got a whiff of heaven.
And he got a good look at heaven and was like, "Oh, this is great. I'm staying." Mm-hmm. And then he had to come back down to Earth.
Yeah.
Worse, he had to come to Texas.
That's
I'm from there, so I can say that.
We call adding insult to injury.
Actually, I really do love Texas.
You can have it.
It's dumb, but I love it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he goes. He really spends almost the whole movie not talking about the fact that he went to heaven.
Mm.
And then his good friend comes to visit him after he's already been discharged from the hospital. He's in the hospital like 5 months. Discharged from the hospital, friend comes over and he's like, "So, something happened while I was dead." And the friend's like, "Yeah, you were dead." And he's like, no, something really happened. And he's like, "What?" He's like, "I went to actual heaven." And the friend's like, "All right, so here's what you're going to do. I know you don't want everyone thinking you're crazy. So what you're going to do is you're going to tell someone else that you really trust, someone who won't, you know, freak out. And whatever their reaction is, you go with that reaction." So he tells Kate Bosworth.
His wife.
Who? Kate Bosworth, during this film, glides through it like the most serene angel. Her every move is sort of soft and fluid. The way she walks, the way she sits, the way she speaks is sort of, I don't want to say Stepford, but it is a very sort of peaceful.
Well, she's married to the director, you know.
She's not, yeah. The Polish brothers.
Yes, well, one of them.
She's married to one of them. Remember how their careers were so red hot about 16 years ago?
Yeah, they were like the hot Sundance thing, and now they're making Christian movies. Or one of them is.
I find that very interesting, and I don't know
what that's about.
What that's about. Did they choose that? Did that become, you know, is there Christianity happening in his life?
Or is this just a gig?
Is this just a gig? We don't know. So he tells Kate Bosworth, and she looks at him, and she barely registers any emotion, and she goes, "Tell me more." So he tells her more. He's like, "Okay, so this is, I saw all these people you know, people you don't know, people I grew up with, old people, young people, a friend of mine who died in college in a car accident, you know, all this stuff." He's like, "I saw them all, and they were all ready for me. And then I came home, and now I've been angry. Because it's so great up there that I didn't want to come back." He goes, "But you've been such a perfect wife. You've been doing nothing but caring for me this whole time, and now I feel like a jerk." The end. He writes a book about it. It sells like a bajillions of copies. It's translated into 40 languages. He's still a preacher in some church somewhere now. He's like 60, whatever now. They show the real dude at the end of the movie. Mm. They show the pictures of the real accident and everything. Back in the day, he did look like kind of sexy Ned Flanders.
Yeah.
So,
I understand there's a lot of McDonald's in this movie.
I'm going to get to that right now. thank you for segueing that, because I was saving that for the end. This is the Mac and me of evangelical medical trauma films.
That's put that on the poster.
They go to McDonald's so many times. Kate Bosworth drives through the McDonald's and orders a double order just because it's her habit.
Mm-hmm.
After she goes to the hospital for the first time, she takes the kids to McDonald's. They all sit around the table at McDonald's and Kate Bosworth says, "I never knew a cheeseburger and shake taste so good." Oh. And one of the kids goes, "I'm in love with French fries." And she goes, "Me too." It was all I could do not to shout out loud laughing.
How many people were in the theater?
There were like a dozen people in the theater this morning. Then...
Hadn't they better ought to be in church on a Sunday
they
morning?
Go, I don't know why they were there. It was a 10:30 on a Sunday morning. I was like, why are y'all even here? So then there's a scene where she's freaking out over how like low he's become in the hospital. Mm-hmm. She drives through the McDonald's again. and the speaker goes, "Welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order?" And Kate Bosworth goes, "Ah!" Scream of anguish. There's a pause. And the woman in the box goes, "That's not on our menu." It's crazy.
When he goes into the golden light after the accident, is it arch-shaped by chance?
It's the same color as the golden arches. I'm not making this up. Okay, so let's talk about these three films in order of in rank of quality.
Okay.
90 Minutes in Heaven has the best production values. Mm-hmm. It has the best performances. Hayden Christensen has to spend the entire movie in a bed. And you know what? He's pretty good. Mm. Yeah. Kate Bosworth, she's supposed to be the serene angelic wife. She is.
She is that.
This is not a terribly made film. It's boring because there's nothing going on. Mm-hmm. There are moments of visual interest, like framing and juxtaposition of people and objects and things like that. So, like, it looks okay. This is the best one of the bunch.
Okay.
Captive has such bizarre tone problems that the actors, Kate Mara and David Oyelowo, are trying. They are trying hard to keep up with what this bizarre script demands of them and this weird story. And they're good. But it's a bad film. Hmm. And just, its association with Rick Warren is just so repulsive.
Yeah.
I've given Rick Warren money by buying a ticket to it.
Blech.
Yeah. War Room is... like made for 35 cents and made by people who are still sort of finding their way in the world of filmmaking.
Right.
Like for the folks who made War Room, it's about, let's point the camera at the people and the people will say the thing. And then we're going to point the camera at other people and other people are going to say a thing and they're going to walk across the room while they're saying a thing. And that's going to be the story. And so the next shot is going to be these people. They're going to be talking and they're going to be walking across a room and saying other things.
Ta-da.
Yeah. It's not, you know,
gotcha.
None of these films, in spite of their association with Rick Warren. Oh, and by the way, the Benham twins. Ugh. Perhaps you know who they are.
The ones who lost their HGTV
yes.
show.
Because... sons of anti-abortion crusader Flip Benham.
Mm-hmm.
They're in War Room, but they don't have speaking parts. Ah. But if you're me and you're obsessed with this subculture and you know all about all the folks,
yeah,
you recognize them. They're like twin blonde Frankensteins, and so you can't not notice them.
Right.
They
couldn't get any of the Duck Dynasty guys?
Thank you for making that point. Unlike God's Not Dead, mm-hmm. which is toxic and cruel and mean and hateful, these three movies are not. One movie's about praying, mm-hmm. praying and loving people. Mm-hmm. Another movie is about a community of people coming together to take care of a guy in a hospital and loving him. And one is about a woman who's just struggling and who accidentally gets kidnapped and decides to read a nice book to the kidnapper and then magically he lets her go. Which is how it went down in real life. Because the guy's, you don't know if the guy's crazy or dangerous or mentally ill. There's no insight into his
the
character.
The movie doesn't bother.
Yeah. And so none of them have any animus in their heart toward non-believers.
Right.
Unlike God's Not Dead.
Right.
Which is garbage.
Or do you believe?
And needs to be seen so you can see just how gross films like this can be.
I think it's streaming on Netflix.
It probably is. Now, what does it say that God's Not Dead is the most popular of this entire batch? War Room is doing really well.
Yes.
But it hasn't approached God's Not Dead numbers. So what does it say about that world that God's Not Dead is the most popular of the bunch?
Well, I think that audience loves to see itself portrayed as the victim.
Mm-hmm.
And then also loves to see its enemies driven down before them.
Yeah. Crushed into dust, really. Yeah, that's what happens in God's Not Dead.
Right.
All the non-believers, they get theirs mm-hmm. by the end of the movie.
Right.
Anyway, so here's the best part of 90 Minutes in Heaven. Halfway through the movie, this dude in the audience mm-hmm. gets up, goes to the aisle where the handrail is,
mm-hmm.
starts doing leg stretching exercises. Like, his foot is up on the handrail, and he's just like...
Is he between you and the screen?
Bending over. No, he's off to the side.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He's just... He's doing leg stretching exercises. So I sat there and watched him for like 5 minutes. Because all there is that's happening on screen is Hayden Christensen in bed going, And so, like, I'm watching the guy doing exercises. It's like... Here's the other crazy part. He came with 3 other people. Like, he had 3 friends with him, and they were all just like, okay, sure, yeah, go do your leg thing. It's leg day. Yeah, go sure. do that.
Yeah.
And so he's off to the side of the theater.
He's multitasking.
Doing leg exercises, stretching. He's stretching his back. He's got his arms bent, his whole body bent over. He's leaning forward to touch his foot up on the rim. He does it against the seats. Like, he puts his feet up on the armchair of a row. The row right in front of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And he's doing the exercises. Then he takes a phone call. And then he comes back, sits down with the people he's with, turns on his phone, and is just sort of like texting. Yeah, like, he does not care about anything. He was the first one out of the theater. The last person out of the theater was me, but the second to the last person out of the theater was this woman. And as I was standing up in the aisle, just watching the credits, she walked right up to me, touched my arm. Yeah. And she goes, how are you today? I said, I'm fine, ma'am. Thank you very much. She goes, that's good. You have a nice day.
Hashtag blessed.
I was like, I like her. Maybe she'll buy me lunch. So I just followed her out. We didn't talk, though. She was done with me.
Yes.
I was kind of hoping to get some Chick-fil-A out of it. There's no Chick-fil-A in the Chick-fil-A Burbank. I wish there was a Chick-fil-A in the Burbank.
And it's Sunday anyway.
Yeah, you're right. It wouldn't have been open.
Yes. Also, you shouldn't be eating Chick-fil-A.
Come off it.
Look, if we're going to be mad at Rick Warren, I think we still need to be mad at Chick-fil-A.
Maybe you're right.
Rick
Warren doesn't offer me delicious spicy number 3.
It's a sacrifice, I grant you. And McDonald's has that buttermilk chicken sandwich now, and
it's not good.
It's not terrible, but it's not Chick-fil-A.
Not good.
It's not Chick-fil-A.
Not good.
Have you had it?
Yes.
Okay,
I tried it. Right. I tried it during the whole Chick-fil-A situation.
No, this is a new one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was the Southern chicken sandwich.
Yeah,
it was trying really hard to beat Chick-fil-A. This is different. It's a little, it's not quite trying to be the same.
I don't go to McDonald's anyway.
That's why I was surprised that you had tried it.
Yeah. So the, I thought you meant
no. The
other one. Okay, so I'm still in the mall, and I go to the kiosk for the phone. I go to the kiosk.
There's a machine that will buy your cell phone.
Yeah, because we just upgraded our phones.
Yes.
You got the 6 Plus. I got the 6.
Mm-hmm.
You got rid of your, what was it, a 5?
I think it was a 5.
You're done with your 5. And mine was an old Samsung.
Slidey keyboard.
Operated
phone.
By a pterodactyl.
Yes. A dumb phone.
That is from the Flintstones. And so I go to the kiosk. It is a whole ordeal. First of all, that machine talks to you.
Mm-hmm.
It says, now do this. First thing you got to do is put your license in.
Sure.
So it can identify you. Which, I hadn't considered that as a thing, but it makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, what if you just go steal phones and throw them in the kiosk to get some cash for
exactly,
the phone?
Exactly, yeah.
It spits out a little sticker. You got to put a sticker on your phone.
Mm-hmm.
and then it reads the sticker and reads the model of your phone.
Hmm.
And, like, it scans it and tells you what kind you have.
Uh-huh.
I have a Samsung, you know, quadruple zero. Dumb.
Yes.
I put it in the machine, and it says, "We're sorry."
Are you even kidding me with this?
The machine says, "We're sorry. Your phone is too old for us to give money for." I'm not kidding. It says, "We will gladly recycle this phone for you right now if you like." But it didn't say how.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just took it.
Okay.
Yeah. And I couldn't put yours in because it belongs right to you, and the cops. Apparently there's a cop that lives inside the machine. That if you give someone else's phone and you say it's yours, they immediately arrest you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? Take your phone to, like, Kinko's. Don't they always have that big, like, green plastic tube you can put old phones in, and they give them to, like, battered women's shelters?
I'm putting it in the grocery bag with the batteries and the dead coffee maker, and I'm going to take it to the electronics recycling thing. But next time you're at the Burbank Mall,
I will take my old iPhone and
take your old iPhone and put it in that machine.
Okay.
Because you'll get some. You'll get 25 cents, probably.
Wow.
At least.
Can't wait.
Yeah.
All right. The big movies, which we haven't even touched on this weekend yet. All right.
Everest.
Yeah. Now, you liked more than I did.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it filled me with great amounts of anxiety.
Sure. Well, why don't you explain what it is?
1996, another true story. People go on an Australian climbing expedition up Mount Everest.
It is
lots of them died.
It's the same expedition that inspired John Krakauer's book Into Thin Air, although this is not based on Into Thin Air, although
it's based on two other books, a book and an article.
Although John Krakauer was one of the people on the expedition, so he is a character in the movie.
And he lived.
Well, obviously, because he wrote a book about it.
Right.
Well,
most of these folks did not come back down that mountain.
No.
Yeah.
And I think Krakauer's book kind of goes more into detail about why it all went belly up. This one, you get some idea of, like, too many people and too narrow a window and, you know, that
too many people, not enough time, and a crucial problem with oxygen.
Right.
That was out. It was either out of their control or an accident.
Well, the movie briefly references some news lady who was on, who was, like, completely unqualified.
Yeah.
And apparently, in the Krakauer book, she really comes under fire for, like, having, like,
screwing everything up.
I see. That's my understanding. I haven't read Into Thin Air, but I remember hearing that about it. I mean, yeah, I was saying in my review on the wrap,
like, she's in the film.
Yeah.
But
she's
not
in a couple scenes.
Yeah, she's only in a few scenes.
In my review on the wrap, I was saying, you can tell this is the kind of movie, and I suspect so is The Walk, although I haven't seen it yet. These are the kind of movies that happen when a studio exec somewhere says, "Get me a Gravity."
Yeah.
You know, get me, like, a movie for adults that they will feel compelled to see in IMAX 3D. And, you know, there are some heart in your throat kind of moments.
There's more than a few of those.
There's a few.
Freaking out about the falling and the high up parts and the...
People suspended over chasms and whatnot. But I think that the problem is because they're trying so hard to tell this story, they feel like they have to include everyone who was involved.
Everyone,
in it.
Yeah.
There's too many characters. You don't really get to know them, so they all get kind of reduced to types. And then, of course, as happens in Whiteout and a lot of other movies involving, like, you know, blizzards, you wind up with a bunch of characters who you can only distinguish from the color of their parkas because they're all trussed up.
Yeah,
you know?
There are moments where you don't actually know what's happening and to whom because they're fully covered. Their faces are covered with the big
goggles
and the oxygen masks are on. And you're like, I don't know who's about to die. Someone just fell off the cliff. I don't know who that is.
Yeah.
Sorry. In spite of that, I was never bored. It looked amazing. I don't know how they shot this movie or where they shot it. Is it green screen? Because if it is, it's pretty great green screen.
Yeah,
stuff.
I'm trying to think. I think a lot of it was shot in Italy, I seem to recall from the closing
credits. On an actual mountain?
I think. I mean, they did some exterior shoots, obviously, in Nepal, but not everything.
It looks like they are really up on that mountain and all about to die.
They weren't.
I know. But as it's one of those films where I'm watching it going, how did they do this?
Although,
how
did this happen? Did you notice that there's a shot where, like, kind of like a helicopter shot where they kind of come over the top of the crest and then they repeat it twice? Like the exact same shot.
Yeah, I did notice that. And I don't know what that was about.
That was really weird. I don't know. I found parts of it interesting and some of the performances were fairly compelling, but after a while, I just kind of felt like there's more here than they know what to do with, you know, and it made me think about, you know, Show Me a Hero, where you had 6 hours, and so you could let it unfold. You could stretch it out. You could have all these some sort of minor characters and their point of view of the larger story, and they came together as feeling like real characters. And this movie, it just all felt so crammed together that I don't think it. It, you know, its eyes were too big for its stomach, basically.
If you're going to see it...
See it in IMAX.
You must see it in a movie theater.
Yeah.
You don't necessarily have to see it in IMAX 3D. I went to the Chinese Thursday night to see it in IMAX 3D. Yeah. $19.95. That's how much the ticket cost.
Yep.
And she tells me the money at the box office. I go, that's a lot of money. She goes, it's IMAX 3D. No, I'm sorry. She says, it's IMAX Laser 3D. Ooh, lasers.
And to be fair, you know, things do look good in there. Like, I saw Mad Max Fury Road for the second time in Laser 3D.
At the Chinese.
Yeah, it looked pretty great.
Well, the Chinese is just a fantastic place to see a movie.
Sure.
And this, but if you're going to see it in the theater. It doesn't have to be IMAX, but just see it in the theater. If you watch this on TV a year from now, you're going to be bored.
Yeah, there's no point.
There's no point. Even if it's a pretty big TV, you're not going to care.
But I don't feel like you have to see this one. I really don't think it's
that good. Not bad. It's just not great.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, yeah, it's not bad. I suppose it's the best you can, you know. Then there's Black Mass, which stars Johnny Depp as legendary Boston gangster Whitey Bulger.
Yes.
And basically about the sort of devil's bargain he entered into with the FBI, namely through one agent who was his childhood friend from Southie, who's played here by Joel Edgerton. And basically the FBI was willing to look the other way and let Bulger get away with whatever as long as he helped them put down the Italian mob. Which, interestingly, is kind of the plot of Sicario, where you have the government sort of, like, helping one drug guy as long as it helps them take out another drug guy. And I was saying that, you know, these are the kind of post-Osama bin Laden movies about U.S., you know, foreign policy or governmental culture. I kind of dug Black Mass. I mean, it's, you know, I think it's hard to make a movie about mobsters in the 70s at this point without rehashing Goodfellas, and I feel like it finds its own sort of tone for that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Again, like Everest, I think it's a movie with too many characters. It's got, like, and they're all played by these really great actors. So you have somebody like Adam Scott or Kevin Bacon or Dakota Johnson who comes in and does a couple of scenes, and then they're gone.
Everybody gets their moment.
Everybody does.
Adam Scott doesn't.
But
almost everyone else gets their moment. And then they might recede into the background.
Yeah.
I found the filmmaking a little strange, although I think it's a pretty good movie.
Mm-hmm.
I feel as though it wanted to be very, very serious.
Mm-hmm.
And yet there's an element of absurdity to this scenario.
Sure.
That isn't fully explored.
The high-life stuff and the
whole weird FBI corruption and Kevin Bacon's character who's like, why can't we get this guy? And you're like, because all of your people are intentionally muddying the water. Yeah.
Right.
And then, like, Corey Stoll comes in and he's like, no more of this.
Yeah.
Like, we're done here. I felt like there were opportunities for a kind of grim humor that were not indulged.
Sure. Well, it's directed by Scott Cooper. Is that his name? Who did Crazy Heart and Out of the Furnace? So
yes.
Sense of humor is probably not high on his.
Yeah. No. I know. No, that's true. I know. Depp's performance, I feel is a hybrid between the old school Johnny Depp performance and something like Donnie Brasco.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Mad Hatter. Because...
because of all the makeup involved?
Because he is, once again, obscured by an insane amount of prosthetics and makeup.
True. But in the service of playing a real person...
In the service of playing a real person, however, it turns him into kind of like a boogeyman, in a way. And you don't learn much about him. What you really learn about are the ways that people react to him. I'm thinking especially, but not exclusively, of a scene in which he confronts Julianne Nicholson,
mm-hmm,
and touches her,
mm-hmm,
all over her face. And she, instead of being like, "What are you doing?" she lets it happen. And every person he meets, he's got that bizarre kind of like, "I'm going to get you if you don't do exactly as I say." Like, even the FBI guys that he's cooperating with, he intimidates them.
Sure.
And so...
But I saw that more as
the filmmaking... Finish your sentence.
I saw that more as in service of the character than sort of Depp doing just another one of his weird...
I know, but it's all one thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the best performance he's given in a very long time.
Yes.
I give you this. But it is, once again, a performance that is augmented by...
externals.
A really creepy person.
Sure.
He's made up to look like a really creepy, unpleasant, frightening-looking person.
Yes.
The filmmaking, as sort of, you know... earnest and dark as it is, helps this performance, I believe, because he is often shown in a darkened sort of light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's not...
In shadow.
He's in shadow. He's emerging from shadows like Nosferatu sometimes. You know, like...
I thought he looked like Uncle Duke from Doonesbury.
Yes! Like Uncle Duke and Nosferatu had a baby. Yeah. So, I feel like this is a pretty good movie with some weird problems that aren't resolved and with a decent performance by Depp.
Yeah.
Better. I think the tendency is going to be to overpraise him for this.
Sure.
Because he's been such a pain in the butt for the past, like, 7 years
yes.
now. Longer. A sort of kind of recommendation.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not bananas for this movie, but I like it a lot, and I think that it's more effective than not.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't love Joel Edgerton.
Everyone sounds ridiculous doing Boston accents.
Yeah, especially Benedict Cumberbatch, I guess.
Yeah, that's a bad one.
You know, Juno Temple gets to play her umpteenth streetwalker.
Right. She needs to watch out about being typecast. Because she gets cast playing... prostitutes, runaways,
mm-hmm,
bad girls.
Yeah, strumpets.
Like, trashy, whatever.
I've
like,
been saying
always.
For years, she needs to play a district attorney. Like,
yeah.
Something. Like, seriously, Juno Temple.
That is, I mean, maybe she thinks, like, okay, well, this is where I'm strong. You know, this is what I'll just keep doing.
I guess. Or that just no one's clever enough to be like, hey, I'm going
to see,
cast
yeah.
you in something
oh,
else.
Oh, I saw you being know? A prostitute in this movie. Here, we're going to do it again.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish that she could find something that was completely against the type that she has been painted into.
Give her glasses and a lab coat, you know.
Right, right.
Anything else? What if we...
Are you going to talk about sleeping with other people? Did you already
talk
about...
I did talk about sleeping with other
people. I already forgot.
Yes.
The New Girlfriend?
Oh, yes! Francois Ozon's new film, The New Girl. Are you going to see it, or...?
Probably not.
Okay.
I'm kind of hit and miss with Francois Ozon. I like his earlier weird stuff. And,
I'm mostly hit, I've had a few misses. This one is a light hit. It's based on a Ruth Rendell story. It's about this woman who, she's married, but she's kind of had this lifelong crush on her, like, childhood best friend, who dies. And one day she goes over to the house to discover that the dead friend's husband has been dressing up like her. At first, to sort of soothe the baby that they had, but after a while, it sort of turns out that he really is into it, and the two of them sort of start carrying on this affair.
Does he begin living as a woman, or
More and more, yeah. At least he does around her, around the woman, the protagonist of the film. It feels a little retrograde given the kind of trans stories we've been seeing in movies of late.
Right.
But it is gorgeous, and it is Ozon working in that sort of swoony Douglas Sirk mode.
Okay.
So it's worth seeing. It's beautiful to look at, and the performances are really good. It does feel a little displaced in time, but it still, I think, kind of commits to what it's trying to do, and it's very sumptuous.
All right.
So, you know, it's got that going for it.
All right.
But yeah, it's not as good as, I mean, I know you just like the stuff like Criminal Lovers and Water Drops on Burning Rocks. This one's more like on the level of something like Potiche, you know, where it's,
all right,
you know, it's nice.
I got a DVD.
Okay.
The Dawn Patrol.
Okay. Is that Errol Flynn?
1930 Howard Hawks movie.
Uh-huh.
Starring Richard
Barthelmess?
Barthelmess?
Yeah.
I say his last name. And Douglas Fairbanks Jr.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Have you seen it?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They had it on TCM a while back under its other title. The other title is called Flight Commander.
Okay.
It is available as a Warner Archive title.
Okay.
All right, so you can buy it
out
there. It's gettable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a World War I movie, and it's about these, you know, British fighter pilots, and they're kind of, you know, cocky and reckless, but then Barthelmess, or however you say his last name.
I've never actually said it out loud. I've read it.
He's promoted to being the guy who sends out troops.
Uh-huh.
And then he has this whole other responsibility, like, oh no, now I have to send other guys out to die.
Right.
And so it's all about that conflict of conscience and what it means to be, you know, sturdy during war and what it means to crumble and how, like, the camaraderie of the group can overpower, like, good sense and stuff like that. It's so great.
Okay.
Now, 1930, this is an early talkie.
Right.
If I'm not mistaken, the actual... it says, like, an RKO, a talking picture, like, at the bottom of the thing.
Vitaphone.
It's so...
So the camera doesn't move a lot.
Not much, no. But it's wonderful. It's been on our TiVo forever because I recorded it on TCM. And I finally watched it. And
speaking of Howard Hawks, our next Linoleum
Knife...
That's
why I watched it.
Our next Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife will be about Gentlemen for Blondes, and we'll be taping that in the next couple of weeks. And a case could be made that, you know, Hawks made a lot of buddy pictures, and Gentlemen for Blondes is certainly one of them.
He did make a lot of buddy pictures, and that was an ongoing concern of his.
Yes.
Gentlemen Prefer Blondes is a lady buddy picture.
Indeed.
And in my opinion, his very best.
it's up there
it's
for sure.
It's certainly the one I want to watch over and over and over again.
I mean, I think probably His Girl Friday is still my favorite, but...
Okay.
Gentlemen for Blondes, totally top
Gentlemen for Blondes, question. Really...
Top
really,
three, even.
Like, Christmas week, when everything's... When no one's working and I don't have to see any movies, that's the movie I want to see.
Right.
I want to sit on the couch, I want a big bowl of spaghetti, and I want to watch Gentlemen for Blondes.
Nice. My DVD pick this week, Olive Films is putting out a Blu-ray of Stephen Frears. Prick up your ears. Yes, prick up your ears.
Everyone, your ears are down. Pick them up.
Which I talked about on Sewers of Paris this week. It is a biopic about... By the way, when did everybody start saying biopic? What's that about?
What?
People lately, I've been hearing the word biopic.
Who?
Various podcasts and on TV and stuff.
They're wrong.
It's so weird,
it's
right?
That's not how you say that word.
I didn't think so either.
If you're saying it like that, you're wrong. It's a biopic.
That's what I thought.
Yeah.
Okay, so it's a biopic about...
Biopic.
I know, about Jordan.
It's not a vision disorder.
Exactly. It's about playwright Joe Orton, who's played by Gary Oldman, in I think his second or third movie. It was right after playing Sid Vicious in Sid and Nancy,
right?
Who was unabashedly queer in the 1960s in England, and about his tempestuous relationship with Kenneth Halliwell, played by Alfred Molina, in I think his first movie or his first big movie, and great film about collaboration and frustrated artists and living in a revolutionary way. It's a really great movie. You should totally check it out.
And getting it.
That too.
There's a whole lot of getting it in this movie.
It's a very sexy movie. I talk about seeing it in the 80s when I was still in the closet and going with Kurt Holman and
people do dirty
and
things.
Just being all like, don't not gonna react to this. Say nothing.
I got some letters.
Okay.
This is from Mint. Mm-hmm. Hey, David Alonzo. I really enjoyed Alonzo's report from Venice last week.
No.
That was the podcast that you recorded with Peter DeBruce last week in Venice.
Thank you.
Especially the commentary around the Danish girl.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought I might offer my experience on the different schools of thought concerning trans actors and trans roles that I have come across.
Let me give some background here for people...
As a cinephile in the queer community.
Okay. For people who didn't listen to the episode, Dave, we were talking about the Danish girl, and I had gotten a tweet about somebody complaining about the fact that they had cast a cis actor for the role. My question was, and I'm glad to have some feedback about it. I'm asking this to someone who doesn't know. I get that, obviously, yes, trans actors need to be cast in a variety of roles, trans roles, non-trans roles, whatever. I'm curious and would like to know about the politics or the whatever involved of roles that involve a transition from one gender representation to another, if trans actors want those roles, have an affinity for those roles or not, or
trans actors want all the roles.
Well, okay, obviously, but let me put it this way: should those roles be treated differently than roles that don't involve the act of transformation or the act of transition?
I don't think so.
All right, that's I'm just
trans actors is an actor.
Right.
And a trans actor is like, all right, well, you want me to show you the transition? I'll show you the transition because I did the transition.
Right. Well, I mean, that hasn't happened yet. I would like to see that
someone's
happen
gonna
in
do
a
it.
Film. I mean, like on Orange is the New Black, for instance, when the Laverne Cox character has flashbacks, it's her twin brother.
It's her twin brother. Yeah.
That's all. I'm just throwing that out there because, I mean, obviously there's other issues about, like, this movie probably only got made because it had a star in the... It had, you know, an Oscar winner in the lead,
right,
blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But I'm just curious about that, the other issue. Anyway. So what does Mint say?
May I continue the letter?
I just wanted to get some background for people like you who hadn't listened to that episode.
For industrial purposes, you should hire trans actors for trans roles. But also for cis roles.
Sure.
To get them into the industry.
Mm-hmm.
For identity purposes, trans roles should be cast with actors of the gender that the individual in question identifies with.
Right.
So cis women and trans women can play trans women, and vice versa for trans men. This performs a cultural function because it reiterates that trans women are women.
So she's okay with cis actors playing trans roles?
If they are the gender that the trans...
Right, I understand.
...character...
Yes.
...identifies.
Okay.
That makes perfect sense.
No, all right.
Yeah. This is why much of the trans community, myself included, were upset by Redmayne's casting in The Danish Girl, especially after hearing that Nicole Kidman was up for it at one point.
Right.
That is true.
Yes.
When cis men are cast as trans women, it always seems to suggest that trans women aren't really women. Or it re-solidifies the Piers Morgan view of trans people from his interview with Janet Mock, which is completely contradictory to the understanding of transgenderism that currently exists. That doesn't mean I'm not going to watch the movie. Just like Stonewall, a movie can be historically or socially problematic and still be a really good movie. Anyway, that's my experience from over here. Good luck with the book writing, Dave. Thank you. Someone understands.
So, all right. So it's about the end result then. So if Nicole Kidman had played a role that begins as male identifying and ends as female identifying,
yes,
is different than having a man, a cis male, play that role.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, that's I'm sure there's a multitude of opinions out there, but I'm glad to hear that one.
Note for Peter. Oh, hey, Reed Martin.
Oh, yeah, this is again regarding something else that came up in the conversation with Peter DeBruge.
Hi, Alonzo. Great show this weekend from the festival. I think Peter name-checked Ray Bradbury at one point, but it is actually more likely to be Vonnegut's Harrison Bergeron from 1961 that is the wellspring of equals. Hunger Games, along with Battle Royale, sure, and Divergent, and all the rest. According to Wikipedia, the short story has been embraced by those critical of egalitarianism and those against socially enforced equality, specifically equality that is engineered by leveling. Anyway, just some random trivia. Great show this weekend. Read.
It was actually a really good Showtime movie of Harrison Bergeron that starred Sean Astin.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, it's pretty good.
This is from Steven. Hey, Dave. Not you. Not Alonzo. Just me.
Fine.
Me.
I'll just sit here me. Quietly. While you...
You make sure to do that.
While you enjoy your letter.
I've been meaning to write all week after listening to your review of the new Redford movie, A Walk in the Woods. I could understand some of your reservations about the movie, but I still enjoyed it nonetheless. 3 stars. I read Bill Bryson's book about 15 years ago. He is so much more than a travel writer. He writes with wonderful wit and self-deprecating sense of humor. I've read all of his books, of which only about half are travel. For Walk, I felt the movie captured the character, Katz, right on. Disorganized, disheveled, slow. I thought Nolte was terrific, even though perhaps twice the age of Katz in the book. His appearance is startling, considering how we remember Nolte in his youth, but also in line with Bryson's Katz. I was looking forward to the movie. Unfortunately, the film lost much of the book's humor, focusing more on the lost relationship between Bryson and Katz. Bryson finds humor in the most unusual places. In Walk, he finds humor in the people he came across, both on and off the Appalachian Trail. In the movie, there was really only that one off-kilter character, played by Kristen Schaal. Don't use the movie as an indicator of Bryson's writing, please, or the belief that he's only a travel writer. He is so much more. A Walk in the Woods is a fast read and a good start for this fun writer. All the best, Steve. That is from Olympia, Washington.
Yeah, it sucks when an author you like gets adapted badly and you have to convince people, no, really, the books are good. It happens.
Okay, I don't know. How long have we been going here?
We're getting close to 90 minutes.
All right, one more letter and we're done.
Okay.
This is a subject line. I stand with Dave on American Ultra.
Yeah, it's a follow-up to the letter you already read.
Thank you, Gareth. This is from Gareth. Haha, I was surprised to hear that email come up on that recent episode. Thank you for the reply, and thank you for not mocking how I used the word totally 3 times. That was appalling on my part. It was especially nice to hear Dave's kind encouragement, since I've been regularly reading his reviews for 10 years or more. So back when I sucked at it, he was still reading me.
You still suck at it.
P- Thanks. P.S. Did either of you write reviews of The Duke of Burgundy or The Tribe? Those are two films that hit me hard this year. I have not yet seen The Duke of Burgundy.
Nor have I.
I did not write a review of The Tribe. I saw it, but I did not write a review.
Yeah, we talked about it on the show, I thought. Didn't we?
We did.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I love The Tribe. It's intense. And I've been showing it to my students, in fact. But yeah, no, it's a movie I like a great deal.
Okay, we have a few more to go, but we're done.
Okay, we'll get to this next time. Yeah, just a quick reminder. We haven't done Gentlemen for Blondes yet, but feel free to get our other extra Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife episodes. They're only $1.99 each. You can PayPal us at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. The titles include What's Up, Doc? The Poseidon Adventure, Two for the Road, Clue, Josie and the Pussycats, The Apple, and a couple of Christmas favorites coming up if you're already in the mood for that, Santa Claus and White Christmas. And there's more shirts coming, and there's
more of everything.
More of everything coming. So we will have things to sell you, we promise. We thank Blue, as always, for our wonderful theme music. You can find out more about his work at bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. Check out ChristyLemire.com. Go to the, by all means, check out the last two episodes of The Sewers of Paris, starring Matt Baume. He's interviewed Dave and me, and we had a great time talking to him. Also, check out the B-Movies podcast, The Schmoes Know, Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley, the Brett Easton Ellis podcast, The Joel Ryan Thing, The Fat Guys of the Movies, The Criterion Cast, Film Spotting SVU, The Game Night Guys, and Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at iTunes, and if you leave us a good review, that really does help people find the show.
We got
just them. Like our recent friends who did...
Tim from Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
PC Devitt. Taco Tuesday Weld.
Greatest name ever.
I'm in love
with
you.
That's up there with Ham Drescher. Yeah. Taco Tuesday Weld. I love that.
Jerry G. NYC.
Mm-hmm.
And Spoony G.
No.
Spoony B.
Spoony B.
Spoony B.
So, yes, thanks to
Spoony
all
G
of you.
Is an old rapper.
Yes, thanks to all of you for those wonderful reviews. They really do help people find the program. So we encourage you, if you've not already left us a review on iTunes, please do. It really helps. Thank you in advance. You can also stream the show at Stitcher Radio or thelounge.com and leave positive feedback there as well. Like our Facebook page. There's also an app there where you can listen to the show. Also, join our Linoleum Knife group page on Facebook where our fans talk about movies. And subscribe to our YouTube channel where we've been posting some of our older episodes as YouTube files. You can follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at LinoleumCast. I posted a bunch of pictures from Venice there if you want to take a look. And, of course, you can drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com with any questions, comments, top 10 lists, and I mean only top 10, not 20
Noah.
Or 30 or 40.
Noah.
10 lists.
Noah.
Thank you so much. All right. It's been lovely. We'll catch you guys next time.
Goodbye.